All right. Well, welcome everyone to Human-Centered Security. I am joined here today by Michelle Dennedy, who is a privacy expert, and she's going to tell you a little bit about what she does and what led her here. So, Michelle, welcome. I'm really excited to talk to you. And just start us off by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Thank you so much, Heidi. I'm so excited to be here and talking to you. So my current role is I'm the chief executive officer at a company called privacycode.ai, super trendy with the .ai, but happened before that happened. And basically what we do is we convert the written word into tasks and requirements that can be measured across an enterprise. So whether you're a small enterprise or a big enterprise, and you want to get a hold on your data and you want to be able to use it, sell it, share it, protect it, not get sued or thrown in jail because of it, you're going to call me.
I like it. I'm sold.
I hope that's a valuable thing. We all use
So
data.
as you were describing that, I was thinking, let's talk about what privacy is. Let's like have a shared definition of that. And like, who is a privacy engineer? Well, like, what do they do?
Yeah, this is such an important thing to start. Well, starting at the beginning is typically the way it goes, right? So, what are we talking about when we're talking about specifically data-centric privacy? There's human rights-based privacy. There's sort of what we understand on the street as being private or having guarded or secret conversations, et cetera. But when you get down to the data supply chain and what is digital in particular, but data privacy, the definition functionally is data privacy is the authorized, and that's a big word we'll get into, sharing, processing, deleting, holding, having, being exposed to. So the authorized processing of data related to a human being, either directly or indirectly. And the authorization of that processing is bound by certain rules, and those are ethical, legal, and sustainable, commercially sustainable, and culturally sustainable rules. So the definition of authorized processing of data according to principles allows you to have a more functional, tangible, measurable approach to protecting data that is essentially the permitted and permissible stories that we tell to each other about each other in various contexts.
That's super helpful. All right, I'm going to ask you to drill down in a couple words. So authorization, is that the same as like identification, authentication, authorization? Are we talking about the same thing, the same definition?
And it's the right thing to exactly to nail down. So to have authorized processing or informed processing or consensual processing or ethical processing, all of those things fall into this category of what is authorized. And so authorization in my lexicography does not mean simply what can I do to I authenticate, identify, give you a role-based path of processing for your data. Instead, what I mean by authorized processing is in context, bounded by use cases, bounded by society. So when I walk into a restaurant and I ask for a table, I may have made a reservation. That does not reserve that table for the history of time, just for my dinner. I don't get to spend the night, and those people are not my staff forever. My authorized period of sharing that little data story of diner at table four is bound by cultural norms, by my expectation, by the restaurant's expectation. So that's a mini example of how an authorized sharing can happen outside of the digital world, outside of a contractual relationship. But when we take that into the online world, authorization always has to be bound by the expectation of both parties. What am I presenting to you as an offer? What are you accepting as the person who's going to engage with me? And how do I respect that choice in a reasonable period of time and with the ability to secure that data, to prove that I've had a transaction if we later have a dispute over who's paid the bill or not, or if that information is incorrect. So there's a lot of things that fall out of the context of how do we share, and it adds to both the complexity of privacy and data protection, but it also, quite honestly, adds to exactly what you do, which is, what is the human-centric piece of this? Why are we building these systems? We're building systems to protect the stories that we tell to each other, about each other, in context, and hopefully provide some value and have some cultural sustainability as well.
That's so interesting. I need to go like off script here, because what you're saying is so, it's just, it's overlapping with some of the things that I've really been thinking about recently. And one of that is around like trust and expectations.
Yeah.
So I may have said this to you before, but Rachel Botsman wrote a book called Who Can You Trust? And one of her quotes is like, trust is a confident relationship with the unknown. And I really like that quote, because I think there, you know, there's obviously a lot of trust that goes into our interactions with the technology that we use. We don't necessarily know how that technology is working. We're like trusting the products we use and the brands that we interact with, because we trust them, and we expect things to go as planned. When I give you this information, my expectation is that you are going to use it in a responsible way. And I'm curious, like, privacy seems, it's sometimes like very, I don't know, like legal and like very definitive, but at other times it seems so very fuzzy, because yeah, it's like based on expectations and based on trust. So can you help me like reconcile that?
Yeah. Well, I love that definition, that it's a confident relationship with the unknown. And you sort of answered your own question in that, you know, defining it in that way is, we can be confident about the todayness of things. So there's a lot of complexity in the law. When you strip away the politics on top of the politics that politicians do write laws, when you strip away, what do we do? What are the nouns? What are the things that we're acting on? And what are the verbs? What are we doing about it? You find a lot of commonality that has lasted, you know, 60, 70 years into our journey into privacy and digital privacy specifically. Further back into trust, think about, for example, there's a wonderful, wonderful Harvard Law Review written by Warren and Brandeis back in 1893. I think I'm getting the date right. It's called The Right to Privacy. And this sort of foundational journal article has a very clear path that is talking about the evolution of this unknown technology. And the unknown technology that they were discussing was something called codacking. And codacking was the ability to take mobile, and I say mobile with giant air quotes, because a camera in the late 1890s was, of course, a giant heavy box, and there was all sorts of stuff that you had to do. But you could take it outside of a photo studio, and you could take it onto the lawn at Central Park in New York. And you might, Heidi, brace yourself. You may want to beep this out. You might catch a glimpse of a naked woman's ankle. I mean,
the shock, the horror.
We're getting crazy. Society has fallen apart. But what he does when he breaks down, he discusses the evolution of how we legally protect trust, and we start to have these expectations of privacy. We talk about what is expected for internal to our homes, what is expected with our relationship with our governments, what is expected in society from certain castes of society, and society in every society is a caste system. And what happens when technology comes along to blur those lines? And so heading into trusting some discipline around the uncertainty that technology will always bring new capabilities to surveil, to share, to potentially privately share or secretly analyze information and stories about us. You see the law sort of progressing into this convoluted, complex thing that it's become. But when you bring it back down to this, what are we expecting of each other? And what are the new operators that allow us to share qualitatively and quantitatively differently? You start to see where you can carve yourself a reasonable path so we can have a confident relationship with this new unknown. We can do the things that we know how to do, present transparency. You hear a lot about transparency, and certainly in the user experience and design world, you can create the feeling of what is my expectation. When I walk into a fast food restaurant, the temperature is very cold. They don't want me to stay around very long. The seats are plastic and hard. There's not a waiter coming to my table and saying, Madame, may I present you your Big Mac? But if I go to another sort of environment, there's 19 courses. You better brace yourself and have not eaten because you're going to be like a boa constrictor for the next 3 days. But you're expecting to have this lavish and private and lush experience. We walk into those environments and there's so many more cues than some sort of a tick box. You know, you're now entering the French Laundry. Please check this box if you're willing to be overstuffed by beautiful and gorgeous food that you can never prepare at home.
That's really helpful. And it's comforting, I guess, to know that like that tension and the fuzziness and the, you said it yourself when you were first defining privacy, like context is so important.
Yes.
So it's difficult to give, same thing with security. It's difficult to prescribe a solution when context is so important. Like it just depends, which I think is hard for some folks to hear.
Yeah. And I will argue, and I'll be a spicy and, you know, hopefully your listeners are tuned to hear it. I think that given the context of the current technology landscape, and certainly the sort of mood of not just the US, but globally right now, politically and culturally, we're in a churn. The user experience and the designers, I think they're more important than a lot of these security people behind the scenes. I think this is a war front that's going to be fought in front of our eyes, our ears, our noses, everything sensory that artificial intelligence and machine learning and deep neural network learning, all this assumptive technology that's going to start assaulting us with what feels like fact, but might not be. It's going to be the designers that help us to start to create more context so that we can start to build and rebuild that trust again.
Yeah, that's really interesting that you say that. One of the things that I write about in my book is one of the ways that designers can help users is to help them differentiate between fake and potentially harmful from legitimate, you know, or authentic. And, you know, it's a broad thing, but it encompasses what you're talking about. We play a role in helping our users navigate safely, however they navigate, right? Like not just clicking on, you know, on a screen, however they're getting around the technology.
Exactly.
And when your senses, you know, when you can see something and you hear something and it seems so real, you know, that changes your behaviors, right? Like it's, you know, what is the term? Perception is real or something like that.
Yeah.
Perception is reality, right? Like what examples do you see from, you know, from your perspective, like from a privacy perspective, where do you see this happening and like, where should designers be paying attention?
Yeah. And so it's a huge question. And I'll give you the glib answer and then we can dig in. The glib answer is every click needs to be rediscovered. I think everything that we're looking at.
Ooh, what does that mean?
We're no longer in this world where we're rewarding marketing officers for number of clicks on a website. Like it used to be unusual and good if you could draw attention to your website. Now it's almost beside the point, right? Unless you have a very interactive, you know, if you're making purchases or something, there's every level. So I'll start with the prosaic. That wasn't prosaic in its time. I'll give it credit where credit is due. But our privacy policy 10 years ago, I was working at a security firm and our privacy policy was 16 pages, single space, you know, normal 12 point font. And to a privacy person and to sort of, I always test policies that I am drafting or responsible for people who are not privacy people. Read it. Tell me what you think it means. Tell me what you think your rights are. Tell me what you think your obligations are. And what does this mean to you? And you know, if any of them are still awake at the end of the recitation or reading, first of all, they get a cookie, a real one. and you know, secondly, I'm like, okay, good. This is that concludes my compliance obligation for the day. The opportunity lost in all of this legal language that is there for compliance as a strategy, which is completely false, is you've lost the opportunity for someone who's willing to, you know, dare greatly by looking at legal documentation or try to support their own rights or defend themselves or interact with you. You've lost the opportunity for an engagement that could be delightful. So thing number one, we had, you know, it was a security product, but it was a security product that was also being sold to consumers, families that needed to tell their kids, like I did when my kids were little, the internet turns off at 10 o'clock at night. They didn't know any better until they were a little older, but I turned off the internet at 10 o'clock, right? I mean, these days it's probably, you know, past those lovely days. But we ended up doing a graphic novel to communicate what I really thought were the important parts, because to do security and to do security well, we really needed to do a lot of surveillance. And I say that in the positive sense of surveillance, of true security surveillance, of figuring out where were people being compromised, how would families be blindsided by bad actors, how could they cut off attacks without cutting off the ability to do banking online and, you know, nowadays do e-learning online, you know, essential services that we've come to rely upon. So I think thing number one, anytime there's an interaction or you expect someone to press a button or enter information as a user and a designer, I think grabbing from a form of rectangle versus rounded edged button, pink versus blue, think about the interaction. What do you want from this person? How much engagement? I think having this sort of debate within ourselves as designers of what's the context, and remember that we're context setting. Is this a context where someone can be gaslit or confused by fact? So they're using a generative AI tool, and rather than seeing the branding on the website and the logos and the potential legal language and all these signposts that could indicate source and could indicate veracity of information, they're seeing nothing. They're just getting a quote unquote answer back. How do we create context? Do we have a fact-checking tool that's right there at the top of the screen? Do we indicate underlining or highlighting? I mean, there's a million things that this is where your specialty is and mine ends. But having in mind the goal is for the person selling that generative tool, they want to A, surveil what people want to do with that, because we're in the early days and they want to find out what are the businesses and the ROI of generative AI. They want to figure out the source. So as we start paying people for data sets, what are the data training sets and what are the outcomes that will be the valuable in this new economy, training source resources in their own supply chain. So there's all sorts of stuff going on behind the scenes of that cute little box that says, you know, what do you want to do today? And then for the user, what are these potential sources of bias and harm and reconciliation and safety? So all of this stuff starts to break out into tasks. You know, what are the indicants of ethical use? We know that society is inherently biased towards people with power, certain types of groups, certain geographies. This has been going on since Fred rolled out of the cave and hit Ted over the head with a club. How are we looking for that when we're doing something that we think is privacy positive? So we have this right to be forgotten. It sounds so good. Like, what if everyone could just pull out those embarrassing little moments of their lives? That sounds really great, except this is where designers and artists and creatives come into play. If you go back to the future and you erase the mistake that taught you something to make you successful in the future, you're doing sort of the same thing with people's data sets. So how do we guardrail against a wholesale deletion of a whole group of privileged people on the top so that we're not biasing the bottom set of people that don't have that kind of access and don't have that kind of time? What we're doing is we're starting to build in the ethical engine of design. And what are the things that we can do on the spot before we give information, as we're being surveilled, as we move up the chain and become more trusted and we trust the brands more and more? Every interaction is a context. And so you might not put the word privacy on it, and that's fine. What you're doing is privacy because you're doing the authorized processing of information according to ethical, legal, and sustainable principles. What you're doing is adding immense value. You're not just decorating things anymore. You never really were.
I'm curious for folks who are thinking, this sounds amazing, I really want to do this, but it's just, I'm never going to get this kind of time to think about this stuff at my organization. One of the things you said ethical, legal, and sustainable.
Yep.
Like factors. I can see maybe like the legal piece being emphasized, right? Like we don't want to get sued. We don't want to end up in the news. But the other pieces I can see being having more pushback on, like, look, designer, we just don't have time for that. You know, just go and design the thing like we paid you to do.
Yeah. If you start with legal, you're doing it backwards.
Okay, I like that.
You're wasting a lot of time and you're wasting a lot of money. And I'm trained as a lawyer. So, you know, we love taking your money and we sell time. Most law practices have not really changed their business practice, which is to sell the 24 hours in a day and hopefully provide you the smartest lawyer that can do the greatest output and provide it for as many people as possible. And so I can have all of these little scribes sitting in my little Bob Cratchit nest and take money off the top. They're expensive. I mean, an hour of a good privacy lawyer's time can cost you $1,200 to $2,000 an hour. And that's when you're not in crisis. So it's not cheap, but that's not why you don't do it first. Ethics starts before anyone in any regulator's office even pulls up a blank sheet of paper to create a law. So that's why they always say technology is always ahead of legal restrictions. Now, it bears quickly going into, again, I like to keep going into the past because I think it makes it easier to understand the future. There's two types of laws. One is civil law based, and that's most of Europe. And then there's common law based, which is trial by court, which is really the US and a lot of the Commonwealth countries coming out of the UK plus. And so the difference here is a civil law country tries to anticipate harms and problems ahead of time and tends to have extensive legislation fairly quickly out of the box. And then they hone it down what is actually going to be the thing that gets prosecuted and sort of the regulators will spend their time enforcing. And that's more like the European stuff. And you see that actually every single time. GDPR came out first. The European Directive on Privacy came out first. You see the AI regulations coming out fast. Why? Because they're a civil law country and they're basically saying, here's the rules, go follow them and we'll figure out what works. A common law country is more principle-based and use case-based. So we have principles of law that say you can't hurt anyone if you have a duty to do so and you've actually caused that harm and you are the one, in fact, that is the proximate cause. We try those cases over and over until we see enough of them where you say, yes, we all know that this kind of thing results in this kind of harm. So that's sort of, you know, legal in a box. You know, you're welcome. That's first year of law school in my life. I'll never get back.
That's the best explanation I've heard.
So that's why there's two. That's why you're constantly hearing this East versus West is we look really shallow and we look really light, but you know, we're also very litigious. And it is indeed by design. This is how our court system is set up. It's expensive, it's inefficient, but we find that it goes after, you know, cases, harms, and controversies. For better or for worse, I have no judgment on my part, but you have to know the difference. And you do see this a lot in the Asiatic region. There's so many different countries in Asia Pac, but you do see a lot of more civil law code kind of, here's what the law is, now we're going to go enforce it kind of stuff. So all of that said is, A, if you're doing business in a global economy and you're going to wait for all the laws to click in and then all the laws to reconcile and then to know exactly where you're at with risk and liability, you're going to get that super annoying line that they teach us, I think, the first day in law school, which is, it depends. And what that means is the same thing every designer will say, like, how much does it cost? How long will this take? And you will say the same thing. It depends. Why? Context driven. So what drives context? That's where ethics comes in. And ethical engineering and ethics by design and having ethics isn't just do good. I put that more in the morality camp, which is a little more philosophical. Ethics are the rules that a society has, whether or not they've been written down in the form of regulatory requirements and you know what the harm is and you have all the rules. Ethics are your brand. So you can know that a very engineering heavy brand doesn't want to have some light, fluffy, seemingly capricious sort of a design that feels like, ooh, this is just light and airy. No, they want to have something along the lines of that ethics of, you know, we're very geeky. We have, you know, we might feel like we're super cool, especially ladies in tech. We feel like we're extra cool. But we have a certain solidness to us. So when you think about what you're actually doing and what we have time to do, when you start with ethics first and context, you're going to say, what is the business outcome that we're looking for here? We're redoing our website. Okay, why? Well, you're probably not getting engagement. Okay, how do we mark outcomes and engagement? Well, we want them to get in their buyer's journey or not abandon their shopping cart or read these white papers or whatever it is what activities we would like to do or community that we'd like to create or trust that we'd like to engender. We're not talking about the legal rules, we're talking about the context. So within that context, you're already starting to think through the ideal employee, the ideal customer, and the players that have to play on the field. You've got somebody who's going to referee. You've got internal and external counsel. You've got auditors. If you're a publicly held company, you've got a shareholders meeting and a board so that you've got that scrutiny. What are the things that they're going to want to see in terms of progress and trending? What is your, we always forget that user. So if you're looking at this through and you're starting with a design perspective with privacy engineering and ethical engineering already embedded in your head that I'm not decorating slides, I am the first line of defense of ROI, defense on return of data investment, and getting rid of waste and garbage that is distracting to the relationship we want to build. I want this kind of customer. I want this kind of volume. I want this kind of employee that can attract this kind of customer with this kind of volume. Start there. Your ethic makes the law easy and cheap. I know that I have this type of buyer. I know that I have this type of data. I know I have this type of geography. And I know I'm going to have this type of user journey from beginning to end. There's no mystery. Collect all the data and then it'll be valuable later.
I think it also ties back to something that user experience professionals understand, which is understanding your personas and understanding what that user journey is. So if you really understand the people who are using your product, you understand what they do and what they don't know and what their expectations are. And when they get to a particular place in the user journey where they're going to say to themselves, I'm not really sure why you're asking for that. And I'm not sure if I trust you so much that, you know, you're asking for that. And those are opportunities that if you can anticipate them, you can reassure the user, you know, of what you're doing, and you can use the right words to explain that and make them feel more comfortable. And that's just one example, but like really thinking about who your users are and what their expectations are and where you're possibly going to rattle them and make them not trust you. And the only way to improve the user experience is to really anticipate when those might happen and account for them in the user experience.
Absolutely. And I think it's been interesting. There's a couple examples that have come out in the last couple of years where it used to be sort of sport almost to just think of the user as first of all, a capital U, as if there's only one type of user, and then assume that they're dummies. And we're going to kind of look down our noses because we're technical people and they're not. And these dum-dums, they don't read any policies. They'll share their sandwich on Facebook. They don't really care. But if you talk to any good design people, these are still people. These users are still people. They're motivated by all the things that people are motivated by. And so when you assume, first of all, that everyone is stupid, then expect that you're going to design something stupid. If you expect instead that there's a certain amount of skill set that is common and now culturally relevant, like most people don't use flip phones anymore. Most people have a huge data center in their back pocket that they call a phone. We can start to elevate the discussion of we want clear, concise, contextual information, either visual, by scent, by sound, by color, to help navigate a rather complex world. And so even, you know, young school children or pre-literal people, literate people, can navigate. So it's not that anybody's dumb. Stop thinking that, stop saying that. Understanding the complexity of what you're trying to invite them to do. And then exactly as you say, Heidi, like, how do we invite them to commit to an unknown future together with you? Like, why is your stuff better? What is the thing? Is it a 25-cent taco? At least it should be clean. Like, you should expect that the food is not bad. I don't care how cheap it is. If you're going to hand over your credit card and swipe and take money from someone, I don't care if it's 2 cents. You now have a fiduciary obligation to take care of that information. You have a relationship with that person.
You had me at 25-cent taco, and I want to know where to find
that. Do they still have that? I don't even know.
Maybe 99 cents, but 25 cents would be amazing. I would very much question the hygiene place selling on 25-cent taco. One of the things that we were talking about, like finding the right stakeholders to work with, when a UX team is facing design decisions that they think privacy will be a component of, who should they look for within their organization to pull in and say, hey, I'm working on this. I would really like your expertise so that we get this right and we're accounting for all of the things, and you know, we're not going to be surprised later when you tell us we can't do this stuff. Right. Who are the types of people they should be looking for?
I think there's two sets. I mean, so internally, you know, I think it's still wishful thinking to think everyone has a privacy officer. Most of them legally are bound to have these people. Some of them have taken, you know, a class. So they may or may not have a ton of experience. But I think obviously that's the obvious place to start. Anytime you're dealing with people data, whether they've told you that it's anonymized or not, get your privacy person. They're not, quote unquote, just dealing with identified personal data.
Can you give us some examples too, when you say people data, like what does that mean? What should we look for?
Yeah. So it's interesting because, you know, for compliance documents, you'll ask your chief marketing officer, do you process PII or personally identifiable information? They'll say, no, we don't. And I'm like, wow, you must be a terrible marketing person. Like, how are you connecting with anyone if you don't actually know who people are? And the answer is they've been sort of trained to make the lawyers go away. It's like, you know, it's like RAID for lawyers. I don't have any data, nothing to see here. Go and talk to the IT people. What I mean by people data or information, I'm stepping lightly because there's definitely an accent problem in personal information, personally identifiable information, and personal data. And they do mean different things in different regions. And there's people with full PhDs about personal data, as you know, as in particular the European theater is distinct in some ways from PII, but we'll save that discussion. I won't say pedantic. I was going to say pedantic. That's not fair. That academic discussion for another day. What you guys need to know is the relevant data to you is any information that can identify a human being, or when combined with other information under your control, can identify a human being. So we see lots of people getting in trouble for gathering specific geolocation data. And they say, oh, no. I just watch everyone. It doesn't have to be Heidi. It doesn't have to be Michelle. It's just person. Well, if you can identify a person, it is covered. And that's why the FTC has taken a lot of action on that recently. Information that is your zip code plus, I've already used geolocation. So your zip code plus maybe your credit history on a day-to-day basis. Oftentimes that little trail identifies me. You know, I go to Pete's, I get myself a coffee. I go to this gas station if I still had a gas car, and I'd go to an office over there and maybe I'd buy lunch. So if you just looked at my credit history for the day in a mostly cashless society, you'd say, aha, identifiable person. I may not know that the name is Michelle. I may have put a token in front of it. All of these kind of data streams, and more and more and more with the advent of machine learning at scale and generative AI models, certainly, we're going to be able to pick a human out of this pile of observed data points. And so whenever you can do that, or whether it's possible to do that, even if you are not allowed to do that in your organization, if you actually have access to that information, all of that stuff should be in this discussion. So bring your privacy person to the table when you're talking about gathering information, when you're talking about observing people in a setting, any setting, when you're talking about making decisions based on groups of data so that you can provide pricing, services, directing content at people. At least have the discussion. Not everything's going to be specifically regulated, but again, you're going to be setting your brand and you're going to be setting your ethics so that you're setting yourself up for success. So the legal people have a lot to say here, but so do the processing people. So if you have a data officer, oh, we love it. CDO, chief data officer. They've been doing quality out there quietly for the last 30, 40 years, and we've neglected those poor little lambs. Bring them in. You know, IT
what,
people.
What do those conversations look like? So explain to someone who maybe hasn't ever talked to their chief privacy officer or their chief data officer, which I've never heard that.
They're out there. Heidi,
they're out there. Or their legal team. Like what, how should they start those conversations? What sort of things should they keep in mind in terms of the pressures that these people might feel? How do we make these conversations productive?
Yeah, there's sort of two flavors. There's more than two flavors, obviously, but there's sort of we'll dumb it down. Like I said, don't ever dumb things down. So take that for what it means. We'll put them into two categories. One is the category of the privacy person that thinks it is their job to identify risk, and some of them will say, "Aha, I've been to conferences, I have read blogs, and I have read all the laws, and I'm a very good lawyer." And I see that you're doing something very naughty there. Just know that you can't go into Canada, or you can't process information about children, or you can't, or it's a risk. This is the office of no. You will have to get through these folks, and you will have to figure out how to coax them into, I hear you. Thank you for that great information. There are walls to be scaled or doors to be built into these walls. How, if we need to do this to commit to this brand or this business excellence thing, what are the rules around that? Talk to me more about how does this information need to be respectfully processed? And hopefully you'll start a productive conversation there. The other class of person is really trying to do the same thing that you're doing. How are we legally, faithfully, with as least risk possible in a risky environment, processing information about our fellow human beings, employees, customers, potential customers, general public? And so the conversation you're going to have with them is, start with your business case. Don't start with, I know you're going to say no, but so many conversations start that way. It doesn't matter. I'm hired by the same person you are, or I'm a contractor, or you've come to Privacy Code. I would love it if you'd come to Privacy Code. I'll help you out. But what the productive and best conversations and most fruitful and efficient conversations start with, I got this business problem. We're expanding into California, and we want to do something to make sure that kids with an insulin sensitivity are getting their free school lunch, but we're using less reactive nutritional content lunches. So we're either going to get a new vendor in here. We're going to test to see how the kids are doing on this new diet. We want to make sure that they're eating the food and not throwing it in the trash can and buying some other kid's Lunchable. We want to have our business problem is efficiency. You know, we have a limited amount of funding. We have more hungry kids than ever before. We're missing days out of school. You know, the parents are losing wages. The kids are losing school time, on and on. This is our business problem. When you're talking through that business problem, I'm hearing kids, I'm hearing age, I'm hearing government interfaces, I'm hearing supply chain, I'm hearing vendors. So use your words, and then I will reflect back to you what I'm hearing. Do you need this? And how do you think this? And what is our outcome? And what is the best case scenario? And what is the worst case scenario? And then we start to build and discard requirements before we touch a paper. So when you're talking to these people and you start with your perspective and your risks and your ROI and your harms, we can start to solve the first wave of these wicked problems in a very productive way. We understand what each other's needs and limitations are. We understand sort of the budget. We understand the timing, and it becomes project management, which we know how to do.
Yeah, I like that. Basically doing your homework to help make that conversation as productive as possible. And knowing that when you approach these folks, people in privacy, people on the legal team, like they don't necessarily know what you're working on. So helping them understand using your visualization skills, like can you show them a journey map? Can you show them how all of these things interconnect, you know, in an infographic so that they can better understand what you're trying to do and what outcome you're trying to achieve. That way you can have more productive conversations. At the beginning of our conversation, the book you co-authored, The Privacy Engineer's Manifesto, is 10 years old.
Today's its birthday, January 24th, 2014, we launched.
Wow. That's amazing. It's a great book to just like wrap your head around this thing that I feel like people kind of like talk about privacy and throw words around, but the book really kind of helped me get grounded in like, what does this actually mean and how does it affect the user experience?
And it's open sourced.
It's open source. Yes.
Made it free for the world. So come and get it.
I'm curious, like 10 years later, I think you said when we were talking previously that you had accounted for things like AI, like you kind of saw the writing on the wall. What sort of things were you thinking about, and how have they materialized around AI?
Certainly when ChatGPT made it on the scene and Microsoft enlivened it with $10 billion plus of financing, it allowed a 12-year-old to imagine he could write a whole essay on Great Expectations and get away with it. It has hair salons like able to do contracts at, you know, really just asking and interrogating a machine to draft documentation for them. So it's reached beyond the bounds of Geekville, and it's reached out into the general public, which I think changes everything. We had payments online, we had search, and now we have ChatGPT, not the brand or the thing or the OpenAI, but the notion that now people can see what we've been seeing in tech for so many years, and particularly privacy geeks like me. So the Privacy Engineers Manifesto looked out at a world and we said, we've got to start communicating. Policy has to talk to tech, has to talk to business, has to talk to ethics. And we imagined, what would that methodology look like, looking back at the past 60 years of compute and saying, what has worked? Data maps, sequencing diagrams, UML architectures. You don't even need to know what these things and these words and these specialty areas are. But putting this group of disparate, passionate people in each of their disciplines and having a notion, and that's why it became a manifesto rather than privacy engineering, period, was there's a movement where we see humanity being recorded. We see that Kodaker's ankle on display, except it's humanity at stake. And so if you get the manifesto, go get it. You'll see my badly written poem that I wrote on an airplane about why it's time for us to have a manifesto. It's time to serve humanity. It's time for you as a UX designer to delight people again. We have the data. We can use it for terrible, terrible harm, or we can use it to educate people. We can use it to make sure our seniors aren't so lonely. We can have good democracies where we actually debate issues again instead of people's haircuts. So all of these things are available, and it was sort of peeking out on the horizon, and it can go very, very, very dark. People have done dastardly things with data, but it's not over yet.
I love that. And I love that, you know, how you explained why you chose to make it a manifesto, kind of like a, you know, this is how, like our, this is how we are operating. Here are the things that we believe in.
Yeah, it's a battle cry, and it still is. And it's, I love how many people call themselves privacy engineers. It mm-hmm. was a discussion I had with my dad in 2001. He was a systems architect, and I was still in the legal group at Sun Microsystems. And Ann Kavukian was doing wonderful work evangelizing privacy by design as the public policy. And I was like, Dad, you know, when I go and I talk to the engineers, they just roll their eyes and they hear words like humanity and ethics and law. And they're like, that's your job, sis, not mine. How do we break through? And he said, you know, when engineering first came out as a discipline, I mean, he graduated with a degree in mathematics. There weren't that many engineering, and there certainly weren't any electrical engineering. And he joined the Navy because that's where you got your hands on computers back in the 50s and the 60s. And he said, we had this thing called the PE was the Professional Engineers Ethical Code, and civil engineers still have it. And other countries, if you call yourself an engineer, you have to sign up to certain things like lawyers do. We don't have that here in the US, but the calling them privacy engineers was sort of a play on words for us to say a privacy engineer has a code of ethics. We have a sense that building a span of steel and metal and asphalt over a chasm probably shouldn't crumble into the bay. We should use the right materials. We should have the right place. We should understand the building codes. And then we build.
I love that. So if folks want to get in touch with you, what is the best way for them to do that?
I am constantly chitter-chattering on LinkedIn. So follow me on LinkedIn. And we've got privacycode.ai is our website. And we've got a page on all the socials for that. And then feel free to go to the current version of the Privacy Engineers Manifesto is at apress.com. You can download a free copy, or if you've got a Nook or a Kindle, you can get a digital for free. If you want to throw me 5 cents, go ahead and buy a paper copy. I like paper.
You can get it on Apple Books for free. You could also, and as you said, you can use, you can get it through Amazon for free. You can read it on your Kindle. You could actually read it in a web browser.
I didn't know you could get it on Apple Books. So that's really good.
Yes, you can. Michelle, this has been so enlightening. You're so funny and you explain things so well. I learned so much and I really, really appreciate you sharing your expertise with listeners. I'm sure they have also gleaned so much from your explanations and how you break things down. So thank you. Thank you.